Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the school year comes to an end at area high schools and colleges, I want you to think back to your own time during those years and your assigned reading. Perhaps some books opened a door to a brand new world, but others, well, let's face it, the only reason we read it was because it was assigned. Books maybe like The Scarlet Letter, for example, or Metamorphosis, or I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. As soon as the back cover closed, we said nevermore. Apologies to Edgar Allan Poe. Well, my guest today went back and read 50 classics from the high school years and wrote essays about them and found, with age and experience, most of these books offer some great wisdom and clarity. For me, with a quarter of the books being published after I was in high school, it was an interesting look at what's being assigned. Kevin Smokler is the author of Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. It's a Prometheus book, softcover book, and Kevin Smokler is the editor of Bookmark Now, writing in Unreaderly Times, which was a San Francisco Chronicle notable book in 2005. His writing has appeared in the Chronicle as well as the Los Angeles Times. And he joins us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Kevin Smokler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rich. It's going to be great fun. I'm looking forward to it.
What was the inspiration for writing Practical Classics?
For me, the inspiration was my 20th high school reunion. I graduated from high school in 1991, and I went back to my 20th high school reunion a little forbiddingly, and I had some feelings like, oh, my God, are they going to remember me and all the stupid mistakes I made when I was a teenager? And actually, just about everybody I ran into at the reunion was happy and healthy and had turned into, great people as adults. And it got me thinking, you know, maybe it's time to reconsider the notions I had held on to for so long about some of the experiences I'd had in high school. It was right around the time I was also arranging a closet in the apartment my wife and I share. And I was moving some books around, and I noticed I still was hanging on to some classics from high school, the old tattered paperback volumes with erasable pen scrawls in them, and I didn't know why. And finally, I said to myself, I put two and two together and said, maybe the thing to reconsider is why I still think of these books as boring slogs I have to go through with mud galoshes and write an in-class essay on. I'm 38 years old, for God's sakes. You know, there's got to be something good in them if high school teachers have been assigning these forever. So that was the beginning of the process.
What was the first book you reread?
The first book I reread was The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which is why I also put it first in Practical Classics. And I figured Mark Twain has made people laugh for 120 years. It was probably being a real sourpuss if I couldn't at least laugh when I sat down with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And so I reread that one, and I did some research on sort of how it came into the world and when it was published. And not only had I remembered a lot of the book wrong, but I remembered a lot of the context wrong as well. So the story of how Huckleberry Finn, the book, came to be along with what's contained in the novel was really the beginning of this idea of, hey, maybe books really do look different when we're grown-ups with, you know, jobs and marriages and children and community commitments rather than, you know, pimply-faced 15-year-olds like I was at the time.
You know, a lot of these books are assigned in, you know, middle school to high school to early college, and these are mature, for the most part, mature works written by writers. Are we missing an awful lot by assigning these books so young? I mean, I suppose that kind of goes with education. But
yeah.
I get the feeling from your book that you feel like a lot of times these books are not meant for their audience, and we're just catching the top layers of a particular novel.
I think that's absolutely true, Rich. And I think there is something to be said for the art of teaching, teaching literature in great books. And part of that is the difficulty of how do you take a book which was a mature work, possibly written for a mature audience by a mature author, and give it to a teenager and not have them just grasp a little bit of it but mostly feel sour or down about it because it was a book they had to take a final exam on come May or June. And I think that is really the art. That's why I have so much respect for English teachers. I think the art of that is to draw out the riches of the book, put it in the context of the experience of the student, and also not leave the book itself stuck back in high school days and not worthy of another look later on in life. You know, Italiano Calvino said, a classic is a book that never runs out of things to say. Well, you know, the art of teaching a classic is to not, you know, tape its mouth shut once you've graduated from high school.
Well, now back to Huckleberry Finn. You said you remembered details of the book wrong. And I think one of the things you said was, you know, We conflate Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. These are two very different books. All the humor of Tom Sawyer is not necessarily all that a part of Huckleberry Finn.
Absolutely. I was pretty convinced that I would reread Huckleberry Finn and buy a raft and call my best friend and say, you know, meet you at the top of the river in 2 days. Let's go. And the truth is, the boyhood nostalgia one associates with two of Mark Twain's great works is largely in Tom Sawyer and not so much in Huck Finn. The world of Tom Sawyer is painting fences and hanging out with your friends and going on treasure hunts, and the world of Huck Finn is human bondage and drunk fathers that beat you up. It is a much darker, scarier place. And so I think the power from Huck Finn comes not only in remembering the innocence of childhood, but also remembering that the innocence of childhood is from a different time, and we grow up and we get better. You know, just as Mark Twain, who was in his 40s when he wrote Huck Finn, did, and just as America did. You know, Huck Finn was written in the 1880s, but was about the 1840s. Slavery was 20 years over when Huck Finn was written. And I think what Mark Twain was saying is we've grown up, and that's a good thing. So it's as much an argument for maturity as it is for innocence.
And of course, for Huckleberry Finn, it's the first, I don't know if it's the first buddy novel, but it's the first road novel or the first road movie. You know, that's a popular cliche now, and this was the inspiration for it.
Oh, absolutely. And the road movie, novel, song, you know, that formula is such an American icon and so versatile that it fits a lot of different themes. You know, on the one hand, it can be a story of growing up the way On the Road was for Jack Kerouac. It can be a story of family, the way the movie Rain Man is, for example. And it can also be a story of kind of accepting maturity and where you are in life, the way, for example, William Least Heat Moon's Blue Highways was. That book is not about, you know, childhood or innocence. That book is about accepting mortality and age, all of which are road movies and books. But somehow Mark Twain with Huckleberry Finn created something that was so versatile that we can see many different selves in it.
Well, now, from the first entry, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which sort of set you on this path to figuring out these 50 books that you wanted to write about, what was the criteria for including it and for not including a particular book?
So there are 50 books in Practical Classics, and I had only 10 months to do the book. Those are just, you know, the economic conditions of publishing sometimes. That's just the way this one shook out. And so the very first thing was I couldn't include any book that was too long because I'm a slow reader, and I'd still be reading Middlemarch, and it would be Practical Classics would be about one book if that was the if that was the task I had given myself. So unfortunately, I couldn't do Middlemarch. I couldn't do a lot of the Russian novels because A, they're long, and B, that's a lot of Russian names to keep straight, and I'm not particularly good at that. So I had to limit by length. I had to, in a couple of cases, I cheated and included books that I had read so many times that I didn't really need to reread them. But overall, it was books that I had been assigned in high school, and then I included some that my parents' generation had been assigned in high school. I graduated from high school in 1991, and I also included some more contemporary books like Sherman Alexie's Reservation Blues and Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, because I didn't want Practical Classics to be a time capsule of my time in high school. Right. I wanted it to at least stretch forward and backward, and I didn't really think that anyone would walk into a bookstore and pick up Practical Classics if the message was, here are some books the author read in high school, and you should reread them because Kevin, who you've never met before, said so. That didn't strike me as incentive enough for anyone to pick up this book.
Now, let's go to the last essay in the book, which is you write it in epistolary form, but it's about the book that will probably get a lot of heat this summer with the release of the new movie, The Great Gatsby, and that is F. Scott Fitzgerald's book, which seems like to me it's kind of gone in and out of fashion and being assigned. And I think when I grew up, it was sort of out of fashion, and it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to high schoolers for the most part.
Absolutely. I mean, never mind it is about a time 80 years gone in this country that is difficult to comprehend, that hard enough to comprehend that everybody in Great Gatsby is holding a raised martini glass, and it was during Prohibition. So everybody was essentially engaging in illegality by you know, hanging out at Gatsby's party, which was hard enough for me to understand at the age of 14. But also, you know, when we think about those immortal last pages, when we think about the idea that so we beat on boats against the current, borne ceaselessly into the past, There's a message in there, at least as I see it, about how we simply cannot get back things that are gone. And part of the idea of growing up and growing older and living our lives is recognizing that things will be, for better or worse, in the past, and they are no longer ours. And that is a lesson that made no sense to me in high school, and I think would have a hard time washing with any teenager when a year seems eternal and time just seems to stretch on forever. So there's a central theme in Gatsby, which to me only makes sense after you have some life experience behind you and after you've experienced the loss of not being able to get something back that you once had, the way Gatsby did with Daisy.
What do you suppose is sparking this sort of revival of this? Because I think when most people think of Gatsby, they think of the superficial part of the novel,
the
parties out on the islands of New York and all this sort of stuff, not of that sort of central theme.
No. I mean, of course, there's our conflicted relationship with money. You know, people often speculate that the revival in Great Gatsby, and it wasn't just the movie. There's a well-known off-Broadway play based on the book now, and there's a certain amount of fashion revivalism in the look of Gatsby. And people say, in part, it is in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, our conflicted relationship with money. Part of it is about the temporality of things that the Internet age has defined so succinctly. I also like to think there's something in the story of F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, who was famous as a very young man, but whose fame was already on the decline when he did publish Great Gatsby. And The Great Gatsby was not a hit when it was published. It, in fact, was only a hit after F. Scott Fitzgerald had died, after World War II. So I think there's also a sort of notion in Gatsby of the mirage in the desert that is success, a particularly American idea, but also one in our kind of startup entrepreneurial culture. It seems to be the dark flip side of that, you know, yes, maybe everybody gets to define their own success, but that doesn't make success any easier. It, in fact, makes it more elusive. And maybe it's, you know, and maybe it's as far off and disappearing as the green light at the end of Daisy's dock. That, to me, seems to be a very contemporary notion contained in The Great Gatsby.
My guest today is Kevin Smokler, who's written for the Los Angeles Times and San Francisco Chronicle. His new book is titled Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. And we're looking at everything from Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing to, yes, he does include Catcher in the Rye, but also great books like And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz, which was, I wouldn't think that, at least in the South, that probably doesn't show up on reading lists. But you said that was one of the most important books for you of all time and something it sounds like you've probably reread many, many times.
Oh, yes. For those who don't know, Randy Schultz's book, And the Band Played On, is the definitive journalistic account of the first decade of the AIDS crisis. And, of course, in this country, that was largely concentrated in major cities on the coast. I happen to think it's the greatest work of journalism of the 20th century, and it is the book that got me back into reading as a disgruntled college student, and also the book that made me want to take my own writing seriously. The book about AIDS that I think speaks to a Southern audience a lot more, that I would recommend almost as strongly as And the Band Played On, is My Own Country by Dr. Abraham Verghese, which was about an infectious disease clinic he ran in the mountains of eastern Kentucky in the 1980s. And it is the other story of And the Band Played On, the story of AIDS in this country that is not based on big cities on the coast.
Hmm. What was the most satisfying reread, and what was the most surprisingly satisfying reread?
The most surprising one for me was probably Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. I was pretty convinced, both as a teenager and as a grown-up, perhaps small-mindedly, that a bunch of 19th century aristocrats didn't have much for a simple Midwestern boy from the middle of the country like myself. And the truth is, the thing a great book and a great movie and a great song and a great piece of theater can do is make you feel something for people that are nothing like you. And I can't tell you how much I felt for the characters in that book and their trouble, not only with the love affair they couldn't have, but with how much or little they could not accept the circumstances into which they were born. And the amazing thing was, Edith Wharton was 57 years old when she wrote that book. The Age of Innocence was a long time ago. She was living in France and was divorced, which is something, you know, good proper ladies of her age did not do. She had been a World War I correspondent. I mean, Edith Wharton was badass. and there is some of that in The Age of Innocence as to how assured she is about this world that she grew up in and how much she does not judge it, but she also doesn't really let its superficiality get off the hook either. You're really in the hands of a master with that book, and it's clear to me.
Most satisfying? What was just
least satisfying?
Yeah, the most satisfying overall, perhaps.
Oh, so that was definitely one of the most satisfying. The most satisfying. Edith Wharton is up there. Emily Dickinson's poetry is up there for the same reason. You read Emily Dickinson's poetry, and you learn a little bit about her life, which I've included in the essay on her in Practical Classics. Emily Dickinson was not some frail shut-in that sat in an attic all day long writing poems and was afraid of letting the world in. She corresponded with the great intellectuals of her day. In her prime, she was writing 7 to 8 poems a day. You know, that's something I couldn't do. She was pretty badass, too. And I really appreciate finding these things out about people that we have a sort of singular fixed notion of from back in high school.
Let's talk about one of the books that everybody hated to be assigned, probably hated reading, vowed never ever to pick up
just
again.
One?
Well, there's one in particular, and I think you probably know what I'm talking about, and that is the book you referred to, the writing as graceful as a teenage boy on a prom date, recounting events as a court reporter, reading back testimony. You spent basically a whole page denigrating this book, and that is Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. So was it worth rereading, or is that one you should perhaps maybe just let it lie?
Well, so the essay on The Scarlet Letter is called The Scarlet Letter, I Didn't Like It Either. The reason is because I probably had 50 conversations with people about the books I was to reread, and every time The Scarlet Letter came up, someone just shook their head and said, never again, never, never again. I didn't care for it the first time around. I didn't care for it the second time around. The purpose of making it one of the 50 in Practical Classics was not to say, you know, grit your teeth and slog through it. It's to say it was more of a stand-in for the act of difficult reading. You know, not every book is supposed to, you know, give us a hug and bake us a plate of cookies. Books are also supposed to challenge us and to infuriate us and to make us and to lift us up and throw us down. They're supposed to do all of the things that a great friendship or love affair is supposed to do. And because of that, I used The Scarlet Letter to say, you know what, maybe one of every 10 books should be one that could potentially drive you crazy. You know, if we want to live rich, varied lives as readers, we can't just eat dessert. Sometimes we have to eat green vegetables, too, which makes dessert all the sweeter when it comes around. So maybe one of every 10 books needs to be whatever is the version of The Scarlet Letter in your life, but I will not go back to The Scarlet Letter.
Well, let's talk about another one that might be not on the first 200 books you would consider, and that would be Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan. Of course, Marshall McLuhan gave us the idea the medium is the message, the global village, the age of information. We shape our tools and our tools shape us. But how many of us are going to go back and reread that unless we're assigned it?
No, that's true. That's true. And McLuhan, you know, reading McLuhan is like putting on 8 sets of clothes and then trying to take them off in the opposite order. His work is incredible ideas, but man, are they presented in a tangled mess. He was famous for telling many interviewers when interviewers would say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. You just contradicted yourself. And he would say, you don't like those ideas? I got other ones. And he would just go on with something else. So what I've done, the essay on McLuhan in Practical Classics is called Understanding Marshall McLuhan. And I try the best I can to summarize the sort of key takeaways of Marshall McLuhan because, you know, we all know we are living in an age where consuming media is frequently considered the largest activity, the most time-consuming activity people do other than eating or sleeping or working, which is baffling to think about. And I'm sure something McLuhan could not have considered when he passed away in 1980. So I think what I actually do suggest with McLuhan is instead of saying, give me a taste of this guy, I'll go ahead and pick up Understanding Media, which will be like diving into a giant sticky pool of taffy. I would instead say, find a good interview with Marshall McLuhan and just try and take the essay I wrote on him and just use one as a code to crack the other and just try and follow along as best you can. And pause regularly, not only to have a drink of something stiff, but to consider how prescient this was and how much McLuhan could see the world that was to come that, you know, of course he never got to experience.
My guest today is Kevin Smokler. He is the author of Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Well, this is a time when you might say, well, I'm going to pick up one of these books. Give us about five or six that are really, you know, worth our time and will be enjoyable and perhaps give us new insight into something that we might have read, or for some of us who are a little older, something that is a sign now that we've never read.
Absolutely. So let me just say I have two schools of thought when it comes to rereading, which I call the cannonball and the dog paddle. The cannonball is if you want to, you say to yourself, I want to familiarize myself with Mark Twain's book, I'll pick the most famous one and I will just belly flop right in, or cannonball right in, I should say.
Right.
And then the other way is the dog paddle, which is the one I subscribe to, which is I will take the easiest and shortest of this author's books, and I will wade in a little bit at a time. I am a firm believer in the dog paddle method. You may not get the author's best book the first time around, but you will get the most pain-free taste of what they do. And hopefully it will be enough to spurn you on to read or reread more of what they do. But I don't believe you familiarize yourself by taking a giant bite and getting a stomachache. I believe you familiarize yourself by taking a nibble. Now, that said, of the books in Practical Classics that I think would make great summer rereading, certainly Carson McCullough's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
I also include in here a more contemporary book, Sherman Alexie's Reservation Blues, which is about the world's first Native American rock and roll band, and is tremendous fun, and a beautiful, beautiful novel, and totally worth reading or rereading. I also include The Hound of the Baskervilles from Sherlock Holmes,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure everybody's seen, you know, six movies and three TV shows about, but it's totally worth reading as a book. Also,
and really all of the books are really worth, I mean, most
oh, yeah,
of them are
yeah.
really, if you've seen any of the new adaptations, going back to the original is not that big a slog at all.
No.
And they're fun.
And that Arthur Conan Doyle could put a story together, couldn't he? And then I would also say any of the stories of Shirley Jackson's, which are you know, sort of gleefully sickly fun. I talk about the lottery.
In this book. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but all of her stories are a hoot. And then, you know, it may seem a little on the young side for grown-ups, but I also include The Phantom Tollbooth, which is a book that I've reread 100 times and still get something beautiful and wonderful out of. And Norman Juster, the author, actually said he gets about 70% of the letters he gets are not from kids, but from adults who reread it with their kids or on their own and say, oh, I understand all the jokes now. it does take an adult mind to understand why there's an island off the coast of the country featured in The Phantom Tollbooth called Conclusions that you can only jump to because you have to. Or that there is a wagon that is silent when you are speaking, when you are speaking and riding in it, because it goes without saying. So great stuff in that book. And I think any of those will get you at least to the 4th of July. And we can speak after that if you need books 6 through 10.
What about the sort of classics like the Steinbecks or the Hemingways? Or I know your Cannery Row was your choice for John Steinbeck. What was particularly interesting about that?
I really love how Cannery Row talks about the power of friendship and the community that friendship creates, and how as we get older, because Cannery Row was written, Steinbeck was in his early 40s when he wrote Cannery Row and was revisiting Monterey where he had spent his 20s, and there's a fair amount of sadness that the life he had had there in his 20s he could no longer have back, you know, shades of what had appeared in The Great Gatsby 20 years before. But I love the idea that Cannery Row is a book that tells us that we have certain friends, kinds of friends, friendships when we're younger, a lot due to proximity and common interests. And then imagine trying to find his community as tight as the one you found in your college dorm or at your very first job amongst your, you know, the other people you worked with. And then the struggle I think we all have in trying to have that kind of community of friends as we become older, and the primary relationship in our life becomes our spouse and our immediate family. I love how Cannery Row captures that, and I feel like it's a great book for summer reading because the whole thing is drenched in sun and the smell of salt water, and of course, it is the perfect book to take with you if you are going to spend some time visiting old friends this summer.
Now we're going to finish up with a little bit of Shakespeare. You do have a chapter on Shakespeare, and it was interesting your advice. You said read a sonnet. Maybe instead of reading a play, go see a play. I mean, really, when you think about it, that's how Shakespeare meant you to see his work in the first place.
Absolutely. Shakespeare, not only was it meant to be seen, but the Globe Theater and the places where Shakespeare's plays went up were loud, unruly affairs. There were no bathrooms, so people were frequently sneaking out in the middle of the plays to go take care of themselves outside. Plays were frequently immediately after lunch or during lunch, so people frequently ate during productions, and when they didn't like what they heard, it was commonplace to take your lunch and hurl it at the stage and complain about the direction that the plays went loudly. They were popular entertainment. And I think, possibly the most mature revelation I've come to doing practical classics is these books, have withstood the test of time, not because a mean old group of English teachers has forced, innocent kids to read them. They've withstood this test of time because there's something magical and wonderful and great about them that speaks to us throughout the different stages of our lives. But with Shakespeare, it is all too easy to just get intimidated by all the cultural baggage he and his work carries with him. The fact that Shakespeare is sort of synonymous with genius. And when a snobby person says Shakespeare, what they're really saying is, I like Shakespeare, therefore I'm a better person than you. And I say, there's so much to enjoy in Shakespeare, but for God's sake, let's stack the deck in our favor a little bit. Please, cheat. Read the Cliff Notes. Read the Wikipedia entries. Read the plot summaries so you don't go to a Shakespeare play or pick one up from the library and spend the first 20 minutes just trying to keep the names straight. That's no fun. Find a good local production and see a good local production. Have dinner first, have dessert afterwards, because why wouldn't you, for that matter? If Shakespeare was meant to be enjoyed. Most of the audience, a good part of the audience at the Globe Theater was apprentices getting off, wild young men getting off their shift at the blacksmith shop who were trying to grab a little entertainment before they went out drinking for that night. I mean, it was a matinee.
Yeah.
If the audience in Shakespeare's time regarded what he was doing was great fun, I don't know why we're throwing rain all over the party and deciding it's not allowed to be that. I really think we should make it as much fun as we can. And believe me, Shakespeare's gifts will not suffer if we make it fun. His gifts are all too apparent for that.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Practical Classics. Kevin Smokler, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rich. This was so much fun. It was really a pleasure to be here.
Kevin Smokler is the author of Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. It is a Prometheus paperback original. He writes for the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and you can learn more at kevinsmokler.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.